This program has been recorded for a print and visually impaired audience. Welcome to Tales from Tar Heel Ghosts. I'm your host, Laura Ardwood. When I was young, my best friend Bonnie Sykes would scare me with stories of ghosts and ghouls who haunted my native North Carolina. Later, I discovered her stories had come from a book written by her uncle, John Hardin, titled Tar Heel Ghost, published in 1954. Tonight, my friends, Nicola Loeffler, Phil Lewis, Kurt Benrud, and I bring you Tales from Tar Heel Ghosts.
This is Nicola Loeffler reading A Ghost with a Mission. Ghosts, like human beings, sometimes show signs of having an innate desire to perpetuate themselves. They get into all sorts of records, including court records. In fact, there are indications that ghosts have an affinity for courthouses, because many a local temple of justice has its pet ghost. North Carolina jails are usually in or near courthouses, and in other days, hangings frequently took place adjacent to courthouses. Scaffolds and barred windows are regular ghost bait. And so, many a quiet little county seat has come to have a ghost or two. How the desire to get on the record, to become at least a recorded legend, took one phantom into the annals of our courts, comprises a lively ghost story that comes directly from Davie County records in the courthouse at Moxville. The story has been authenticated by several painstaking investigations. It has to do with a ghostly intervention through which an injustice was apparently corrected by the persistent activities of a ghost. Or maybe it was all in the determination of a Davie County farmer who was so intent on correcting his own mistakes that even death failed to stand in his way. At any rate, in the years just preceding the 1920s, James L. Chafin farmed in Davie County. He and his wife and four children lived a few miles from Moxville, a quiet little county seat town of fewer than 2,000 persons, which had been settled in the 1740s by Scotch-Irish, English, and German colonists. The children, all sons, were John, James, Marshall, and Abner. On November 16, 1905, Chafin made a will, properly attested by two witnesses, in which he demonstrated a strong liking for and leaning towards his third son, Marshall. In that will, he bequeathed his entire farm to Marshall. He also named Marshall as sole executor of his estate. In this document, he made no provision whatever for his wife and his other three sons. In early autumn of the year 1921, James L. Chafin suffered a fall which resulted in his death on September 7th of that year. A few weeks later, Marshall Chafin obtained probate on the will that his father had made 16 years before. The mother and the three brothers made no contest of the matter, apparently accepting the judgment and action of the husband and father in the disposition of his acreage. They seem to have reasoned that there was no legal basis for action, and felt even more strongly that if this was the arrangement the senior Chafin wanted, they would accept it without protest. For 4 years, things went along in an even tenor, as is the way of rural Davie County. The wounds caused by the death of Chafin and the strange disposition of his estate had apparently healed. But in the spring of 1925, James Pinckney Chafin, the second son, began to have what he described as vivid dreams of his father. In these dreams, the father came to the bedside and just stood there, saying nothing. This went on for weeks. During these weeks, the presence of the silent apparition of the father was becoming more and more real to James. The figure always came to stand beside the bed in the dark hours of midnight. James said that in these strange dreams, his father looked to him exactly as he had looked in life. In June 1925, when James Chaffin and other Davy farmers were getting most of their crops planted, the father appeared for one of his nocturnal visits. Only this time, James noticed something different. His father was wearing a familiar black overcoat. And it was on this particular visit that the apparitional father spoke to his son for the first time. James said that his father took hold of the front of his overcoat, pulled it back, and said, "You will find my will in my overcoat pocket." And with that speech, he was gone. James said it was all so real that he was sure for a time that he was awake and that it wasn't a dream at all. After this particular visit, there was no longer any doubt in the son's mind that his father's spirit had come to him in the night to seek aid in rectifying some mistake. So in the early hours of the following morning, James went to his mother's house and asked for the particular black overcoat that had belonged to his father. But the mother said she had given the coat to the oldest son, John, who had meantime moved to a farm in the adjoining county of Yadkin. Burning now with a desire to get to the bottom of the strange mystery of the nightly visits by his father's ghost, James went on to his brother's home 20 miles away. There he found the black overcoat, and he and John examined it, paying particular attention to the pocket that the spirit of his father had indicated with a gesture during his appearance the night before. The sons found that in one place the lining had been sewed together. They carefully cut the stitches, which had been made by hand, and found inside this portion of the coat a small roll of paper tied with a string. Excitedly unrolling the paper, they found, not a will as they had anticipated, but a single sentence written in their father's handwriting. This said, "Read the 27th chapter of Genesis in my daddy's Bible." James now felt that he was certainly on the trail of something very important, so he headed back again to the home of his mother to examine the Bible that had belonged to his grandfather. And thinking the matter over on the way back to Davy County, he decided to take a witness with him to his mother's house, so that if a will were found in the old Bible, he would have this available evidence as to that fact. A neighbor, Thomas Blackwelder, went with James Chaffin as a witness to any discovery that might be ahead. But the mother wasn't sure where the Bible was, it developed, and considerable searching was necessary before it was found in a drawer of a chest in an upstairs room. When it was finally located, additional witnesses were present. James, his neighbor, his mother, James' wife, and their 15-year-old daughter were witnesses to what was found in the well-worn, well-used book. Actually, the Bible was so dilapidated that it was in pieces. Blackwelder took the portion of the disassembled book that had Genesis in it and turned to the 27th chapter in accordance with the directions James had found sewed into the father's black overcoat. At that place in the old Bible, the excited searchers found that two leaves had been folded together so as to form a pocket. In this pocket lay a document. Unfolding it, the little group found this writing: "After reading the 27th chapter of Genesis, I, James L. Chaffin, do make my last will and testament, and here it is. I want, after giving my body a decent burial, my property to be equally divided between my four children, if they are living at my death, both personal and real estate divided equal, if not living, give share to their children. And if she is living, you must take care of your mammy. Now, This is my last will and testament. Witness my hand and seal, James L. Chafin, this January 16, 1919. North Carolina law makes a will valid if it is all in the testator's handwriting, whether or not it has been attested by witnesses. The will found in the Bible had not been attested, but it was in the handwriting of the elder Chafin, which the widow and her sons well recognized. The chapter in Genesis, which the elder Chafin read and had referred to in this later will, unfolds the story of Jacob and Esau, and how Jacob got his father's blessing and birthright at the expense of Esau, his older brother. As mentioned above, the earlier will, written 14 years before and already probated, made the young brother, Marshall, a sole beneficiary. But there was another complication. A year after the father's death, the son, Marshall, had also died. The property which had gone to him under the terms of the first will legally passed into the hands of his widow and a son who was still a minor. But the family moved to correct the injustice that was making the uneasy spirit of the dead father roam with the wind at night and appear before one of his sons in an appeal to execute this certain mission. On the basis of the newly discovered will, suit was brought against Marshall's widow to recover the property in accordance with the provisions of the later document. In early December, about a week before the trial of the case of Chafin versus Chafin was scheduled to open, the father appeared to James again, in the same manner, beside his son's bed in the middle of the night. James reported to his attorneys that his father seemed to be in considerable temper and asked where his old will was, and that he, James, took this as a supernatural sign that they would win the suit. Meantime, the weird story had become the talk of the Davie County countryside, and the courthouse at Moxville was crowded when the case came to trial. Legal minds had also become interested and were following the case with close interest. There was evidence that the trial would achieve considerable fame with the public and in the legal world. But during the first day of the trial, Marshall's widow had the opportunity of seeing for the first time the document found in the Bible. She was convinced that it was indeed the handwriting of her father-in-law and that it represented his true wishes in the light of a later decision. So she abruptly withdrew her opposition, and counsel announced, following the noon recess on the first day of the trial, that a friendly settlement had been made in the case, in keeping with the terms of the second will. In the weeks that followed, legal adjustments were made and the property was divided. So we are to suppose that the spirit of James Chafin retired from its restless activities to the peace which it had earned after finally succeeding in getting a message to James, which was followed by action in the court of the county. Among the many interested followers of this strange case of an inheritance that was entirely changed as a result of a series of circumstances put into motion by a ghost were those who were intrigued by the ghostly doings and those who closely followed the legal aspects. Persons interested in psychic phenomena also closely checked on the facts. The principals were interviewed by various people, and several reports of the findings were prepared. One such report is to be found in the published Proceedings of the English Society for Psychical Research, Volume 36, 1926-27. Persons who went to the Davie County scene to check on this story for formal reports, learned study, and newspaper feature stories repeatedly commented on the impression of complete sincerity made by the principals. These same investigators wrote of the high character, community standing, and known integrity of all the persons concerned. As a result, here is a singular account of ghostly intervention that is well buttressed by testimony, a chain of events that are a matter of record, simple and sincere acceptance on the part of the people concerned, and evidence in the form of an actual court record. we must accept the word of the Son, who was a central character in this strange episode. James said that the ghost of his father finally managed to convey a message to rectify an injustice for which he himself was responsible. And so the elder Chafin, working through his namesake, was able to correct his error at last, an accomplishment that is not recorded in the story of Isaac and his sons, Jacob and Esau, to which the Davy farmer pointed a ghostly finger.
Kurt Benrood here with The Tablecloth Snatcher. There seems to have been an open season on wealthy travelers back in colonial tavern days, judging by the plentiful supply of stories, none documented, concerning those who were done in as they slept for the money they carelessly carried. Ghostly evidence today, where tavern structures still exist, include bloodstains that will not be erased, spooks at the window, and noises in the murder room. The seaport town of Beaufort once had a tavern that left a story in the wake of its decay. The central character in the story is, of course, a ghost. But the chief supporting character, and the person who produced the ghost, was a salty old sea captain who was a roisterer of the first water, a teller of tales, and a devotee of the tavern's taproom, although he had a home and a wife laying claim on his time ashore. The wife was not well. The captain said she was a complainer and a nagger, and that was why he spent his time with the boys. One night, with the usual gathering at the tavern, hot drinks were being set in front of the convivial group. Several rounds of heated rum had gone before. Hardly were the mugs on the table this time before they were swept away with a great crash. A boyish figure in a cap and jacket had yanked the tablecloth off the table, sending drinks and containers to the floor. The boy dashed through the room, and the infuriated men of the sea followed in hot pursuit. The culprit was soon overtaken. Dragged back into the light and stripped of the cap, the vandal turned out to be the captain's wife, dressed in man's clothes. She had chosen this way to fight the attractiveness the tavern held for her husband. When the captain sailed again, he took his wife along. He said the sea would improve her health. He came back from the voyage with a band of mourning on his arm. His wife had died at sea, he told his neighbors, and he had buried her at sea, down in the Bahamas. In time, this mourning band was discarded, and he seemed as jolly as ever at the tavern taps. And then one night, when the weather was brisk, they were setting them up, hot with butter, and just as every man had a steaming drink before him, a very peculiar thing happened. Mugs, drinks, cloth, and all crashed to the floor. But this time, an unseen hand had jerked the tablecloth. Uneasy moments followed, and uneasy weeks after that, because every time the men gathered about the table for drinks around, and it wasn't many more times in the face of what had happened, the tablecloth shot through the air and the mugs crashed to the floor. Finally, the old captain was deserted by his tavern friends. For a time he sat in a corner alone. Then he stopped coming at all. Finally he withered and died, a lonely old man. Those Carolina coast folks just would have no part of a man who sailed with a wife and docked home with a ghost.
This is Laura Arwood reading A Colonial Apparition, which has been edited for content. Captain John Harper, owner and master of the steamer Wilmington, which made daily sailings from Wilmington to Southport over a century ago, was one of Wilmington's most familiar and best-beloved residents. In the days before automobiles and before rail connections between the two ports, he and his steamer were important features of the lower Cape Fear section. The trip between Wilmington and Southport took about 2 hours each way, and the Wilmington made charter or excursion sailings as well as regularly scheduled runs. It was said that visitors from the interior had not really seen the lower Cape Fear until they had made a voyage with Captain Harper. Local outing parties and groups visiting the coast country, particularly parents with restless children, enjoyed a sail with Captain Harper because of his ability as an entertainer, as well as for the trip itself. The captain was truly a gifted storyteller, and the yarns he could spin were a feature of any voyage with him. The story of the colonial apparition was one of his favorites. Among others, he told the story to Dr. James Sprunt of Wilmington, historian of the Lower Cape Fear, and Dr. Sprunt included it in an address before a meeting of the North Carolina Society of Colonial Dames in the late 1890s, which gave it an early recording. This is the story, reconstructed from Captain Harper's own accounts of its origin and from his many retellings. Many years ago, on a winter night, a terrific storm was raging on the lower Cape Fear. Captain Harper was sailing the steamer Wilmington slowly down the river on one of his regular runs from Wilmington to Southport. The night was inky black, and it was sleeting hard. The ice-laden wind, together with the intense darkness, made navigation difficult, and it was more by instinct than by sight that Captain Harper was sailing his staunch craft on a familiar course. There was only one passenger aboard, a stranger to Captain Harper. He had given his name as McMillan. As the Wilmington made its way slowly along the blinding storm, the lone passenger, seeking warmth and company in the pilot house with Captain Harper, made conversation. He asked the sturdy old captain if he had ever heard the story of the execution of the Scottish Highlanders at nearby Brunswick during the American Revolution. Captain Harper, his eyes peering into the night outside the glass-enclosed compartment, replied that he had not, and asked for details. McMillan, the passenger, said that his own great-grandfather, William McMillan of Edinburgh, Scotland, had been involved in the incident. This ancestor had enlisted in the Camerinians in 1745, and after the Battle of Culloden, had come to North Carolina at the invitation of Governor Gabriel Johnston, whom he knew personally, and had made his home among the Scotsmen who had already settled in the Cape Fear region. In the course of time, he became a Whig, like many of his associates. During the Revolution, he had heard much of the daring exploits of the Tory leader, Colonel David Fanning, who apparently had a remarkable facility for securing accurate information about everyone in the range of his operations. His method seemed to have been to go after and capture special individuals with an eye to the intelligence he could pick up, and he was known for his sudden attacks and his relentless cruelty. In the closing days of the Revolution, in September 1781, Fanning surprised the town of Hillsborough, capturing Governor Burke and other prominent townspeople, and marched them off to Wilmington, then in the hands of the British. On the way to Wilmington, Fanning also managed to pick up William McMillan with two other Highland Whigs who had already been marked as doomed men because of their so-called treason in violating an oath, reluctantly given, which bound them to a hostile sovereign. After delivering Governor Burke and his party to Major Craig, British commandant in Wilmington, Fanning marched his other prisoners to the port town of Brunswick on Cape Fear River between Wilmington and Southport. Here, the three Whigs, including William McMillan, were imprisoned in the loathsome hull of an old prison ship anchored far out in the bay. After a short confinement, during which the unfortunate men made fruitless efforts to escape, they were brought ashore, given a trial that was a mockery of justice, and sentenced by Fanning to immediate execution. They had only a few minutes to prepare for death. The place chosen for their execution was a spot near the ruins of Governor Tryon's palace at Russellborough, between the town of Brunswick and King Roger Moore's house at Orton. At 1 o'clock in the afternoon, the two condemned Whigs were led out. With no sign of fear, they faced the firing squad. At a command, they were riddled with bullets and fell dead. McMillan was then led out. While standing unbound for a fleeting moment beside a tree where he was to be bound again, he made a sudden dash for liberty, where he gained the protection of some tangled underbrush, dived quickly into the adjoining wood, and managed to elude his captors in the thick forest without so much as a wound from the muskets fired after him. Driving himself desperately ahead, McMillan covered the distance of 70 miles to his home in Robeson County by daylight of the following morning, and there he lived to survive the troubles of the times and to die a natural death in 1800. As Captain Harper's lone passenger finished his story, the steamer Wilmington was just passing near the general vicinity of Brunswick, the site of the double Whig execution long ago, and the escape of William McMillan. In the pilot house, the captain and his passenger listened in silence for a moment to the raging sleet and howling wind of the winter storm. Then the passenger recalled a slave superstition he had heard about that very spot. The slaves believed that on stormy nights the ghosts of the two murdered men sometimes walked there. He asked Captain Harper if, in the richness of his river lore, he had ever heard such a story. The captain had, he said, heard vague reports of the presence of such apparitions during storms. McMillan then expressed the view that these ghosts were the spirits of the two Whigs who had been executed by a firing squad. He had made certain quiet investigations and had learned that the twin ghosts had been seen rowing a phantom boat on the waters of the Brunswick port. His own theory was that the ghosts of the two executed Scots were searching for a vessel bound for Scottish shores. Captain Harper was intensely interested, and his curiosity was aroused by the report and the deductions of his passenger. Outside, the wind moaned low and long, and the sleet rattled against the pilot house windows. Midnight approached. Captain Harper said in later years that this night constituted one of the most terrifying experiences of his entire life on the Cape Fear. He was constantly in fear that his ship would founder in the storm. The deck watch outside was taking constant soundings. As the wind rose to hurricane proportions, Peter Jorgensen, the mate, rushed in with word that they had lost their channel and were apparently drifting towards some jetties. Almost in the same instant, the Wilmington's keel passed over the jetties, and the craft was caught fast, a prisoner of the river in a terrific storm. Taking stock of the situation, Captain Harper told his small crew and his one passenger that the vessel was apparently little damaged. He instructed them all to make themselves as comfortable as possible, for they would have to wait the turning of the tide and abatement in the storm. The crew sought the warmth and comfort of the furnace room, all save Peter Jorgensen, who was left deckside on guard. And he continued to walk the upper deck despite the cruel punishment of the frigid winds and flying ice. Suddenly, Jorgensen's thoughts were interrupted by an icy blast of additional fury, and then, through the murky midnight and the wildest winter storm the river had ever seen, Jorgensen saw just ahead the standing figure of a man, clad in unkempt, dripping clothes, hair and beard encrusted with ice, and a face contorted as if from a great agony of fear. The apparition's right hand appeared to grasp the ship's rail, while the left pointed back into the storm. Jorgensen, controlling his own terror as best he could, reached to seize hold of the stranger, but his hand fell on empty air. The apparition was gone. Jorgensen hurried to the pilot house and reported to Captain Harper what had happened. The captain accused the mate of being drunk. But Jorgensen, frightened and trembling, insisted he had seen a ghost. The captain and McMillan decided that they would look about. Jorgensen begged excuse from the expedition, saying that he would not look at that awful face again if they gave him the ship. The men bundled up, searched the deck, found nothing, and returned to the warmth of the pilot house. Jorgensen, waiting there, stuck to his story, as indeed he did for the rest of his life. He said that even in the storm, the dim rays of light from his lantern fell full on the face of the apparition. Within an hour, the rising tide and the driving motion of the ship's propellers moved the ship from its dangerous position on the jetties, and the trip was resumed. No sooner was the Wilmington under way again than a night-flying gull, first attracted by the lights of the ship, and then blinded by them, crashed through a glass window of the pilot-house and fell quivering and bleeding at the feet of the Scottish passenger. Icy air filled the pilot's compartment. McMillan insisted it was a bad omen and that trouble was ahead. But Captain Harper was jocular about the whole thing, or tried to be, and to offset the mate's fear and the passenger's warnings, he suggested that they would have to look out for other nocturnal visitors. "Keep a sharp lookout for another ghost," the captain said. "Just across the water to our left, we are passing the plantation Lilliput, which was owned by old Admiral Franklin of the Royal Navy. The Admiral may also be cruising with ghosts tonight." Gradually, the conversation settled down to the unusual weather, and Captain Harper gave his major attention to steering the Wilmington. Then the windy night suddenly pierced with a human cry from the direction of the farther shore. This time the captain was startled, as he admitted often in later years. By now, everyone on the ship, except the captain, was confused and frightened amid the incessant shrieking of the wind, the roar of the waves, and the inky darkness all about. Jorgensen said he heard a siren's whistle. The captain said it was imagination, but to calm the confusion, he signaled for a full stop. The steamer sank into a hollow trough and started to roll. There were now no engine noises to compete with the howl of the wind. Suddenly, down the roaring wind, there came an awful, agonizing scream. Captain Harper ordered sailors on special watches all around the deck, took more soundings, and decided that he was almost opposite the spot where the old slave ship had been anchored in the story his passenger had just been telling him. He gazed through the storm and the night towards the old colonial anchorage. And then, from that very direction by the compass, the scream came again, a terrible and frightening noise, but unmistakably of human origin. And then some object began to shape up in the night, looking like a boat, and yet surrounded by a sort of phosphorescent glow. Gradually, the two vessels drew closer together, and eyes straining into the darkness saw, just off the rail of the Wilmington, an ancient rowing barge, so foul with slimy seaweed that it might have been afloat 100 years or more. The men on the Wilmington, captain, crew, and passenger, rubbed their eyes and looked again. Meantime, the weird and awful cries continued. Captain Harper ordered his crew to stand by and throw the barge a line, and as they moved to obey, a now thoroughly frightened crew seemed to behold two gaunt figures in tattered Highland dress. Their emaciated legs were held in heavy chains, which extended to scarred and bloody wrist. As far as the attached chains were permit, the figures raised their hands in silent supplication. Captain Harper could think only of the story he had just heard. Everybody on the steamer was awe-stricken until the captain found his voice and repeated the order that a line be heaved to the two men. Peter Jorgensen had started to throw the line when an extra-large wave caught the ship, but he heaved just the same, and as he did, the giant wave swallowed up the rotting hulk. With its gruesome and voiceless crew, it completely disappeared. Only the rolling, tossing river remained, with no trace of the barge that had plainly been there just a moment before. Captain Harper ordered his engine started, and the ship resumed its course. Hardly 10 minutes had passed before a member of the crew on watch shouted that they were running upon a wreck. The course was quickly changed, and the Wilmington barely avoided a collision with a huge mass that proved to be a vessel lying bottom up. To this wreckage clung two men, half dead from exposure and cold. The men were soon rescued and brought aboard the steamer. As the lantern fell full on their faces, Peter Jorgensen shouted excitedly that one was the man who had come out of the night and grasped the rail of the steamer. While the rescued men were receiving aid and attention, they told their story. Their ship had been overturned in the river during the storm. 5 members of the crew were washed overboard and drowned. The remaining 2 managed to cling to the hulk. Although they grew weaker by the hour, they continued to shout in hopes of attracting a rescuer. To his death, Captain Harper told the story with gusto. He never offered, but merely suggested, a satisfactory explanation for the strange appearance of the colonial apparition on that never-to-be-forgotten night. He left it to his always ready listeners to decide between the freakish behavior of a storm and the answer most of them preferred: ghosts.
This is Phil Lewis. I'm reading The Old Gardener. A retiring schoolteacher took up residence in the home of friends in one of North Carolina's mountain communities. She loved flowers and the outdoors, and as spring and summer came, she took long early morning walks to see the flowers and shrubs, and they never failed to bring her real inward joy. She was so sensitive and responsive to growing things that her friends told her she was a true part of nature. Always on her walks, she searched for new paths. One such stroll took her on a mountain road she had not yet tried, and she came suddenly on a quaint little cottage she had never seen before, surrounded by a garden of a breathtaking beauty. Her spirits bounded with the wonderful discovery. She walked slowly by the picket fence to study the carefully tailored walks, edges of boxwood, border of ribbons of blooming color, and beds filled with great flower masses. Coming to the gate, she took one step inside the enclosure to get a better view of the perfection all around. As she took that step, she saw the bent figure of an old man in the walk ahead of her. bowing and smiling, but speaking not a word, he invited her by sign and wistful gesture to inspect his flowers. The silent, smiling, bent old man led her up one walk and down another, gently touching a leaf here and straightening a blossom there. She could see that his plants were his treasures, his love, and his life. She assumed that he was a mute. The wonderful experience at an end, she turned her steps homeward. By now the morning sun was high, and her friends were on their front porch. She dropped into a chair to give a glowing report of her wonderful discovery. As she chattered, a grave expression settled on the faces of her listeners, who had lived their entire lives in that neighborhood. The changing countenances stopped the flower lover and caused her to ask about these serious looks. "That old man was gardener for a big estate near here, one of the loveliest in western North Carolina," was the answer. "He had a little cottage of his own where even more beauty was concentrated, because he could coax beauty and color and perfume from flowers as no one else could. The home place on the estate burned, and the old gardener has been dead for 50 years.
This is Laura Arwood, reading Portraits and Music. Very few of the really old residences of Raleigh, located close up in town and near the state capital, remain. The gradual encroachment of commerce eliminated them on one side. Expansion of state services cleared them away on the other sides. One of the few remaining has ectoplasmic protection of a gentle sort. If you change the portraits hanging in this old Raleigh residence, a musical protest will result. The strains of eerie music from stringed instruments unlike any in common use today float through the rooms and halls. It has something to do with a beautiful woman who once lived there, taught music, and had an intense interest in art. These portraits hung there when she died. They have hung there since. Any effort to change them about or take them down results in a musical protest, presumably from her.
This is Kurt Benrud, and the story is called The Ghost of Maco Station. Among the strange phenomena of North Carolina, one that certainly deserves a place in any collection of North Carolina ghostiana, is the story of the Ghost of Maco Station. Maco is a point on the Atlantic Coast Line Railroad, 14 miles west of Wilmington, south by timetable direction, on the Wilmington-Florence-Augusta Line. It is merely a tiny point on a railroad artery, and would have remained just that except for a ghost legend that has grown up there, giving Maco dubious fame, but fame that has spread far and wide, especially among lovers of ghost stories. The Maco Station story falls into somewhat the same category as North Carolina's famed Brown Mountain Lights. I told the Brown Mountain story in my book, The Devil's Tramping Ground and Other North Carolina Mystery Stories. Although both Maco Station and Brown Mountain have lights that appear and disappear mysteriously, I consider the Brown Mountain lights an unsolved mystery and the Maco Station light a ghost story. The Maco Station ghost light goes back to 1867 and the story of Joe Baldwin. In that year, a section of what is now the Atlantic Coast Line Railroad was rebuilt to include, among other things, a station called Maco. This station point had previously been known as Farmer's Turnout. Joe Baldwin was a conductor on one of the ancient trains drawn by wood-burning engines. It made regular runs west from Wilmington and the sea, touching Maco and other points along the line. In that primitive era of railroading, cars were joined by pins and couplers. Joe Baldwin, riding his train one night on a rear coach, suddenly realized that it had become uncoupled. Another train was following, and Joe Baldwin's immediate fear was that this second train would plow into the free car before his distress would be noted or remedied. He therefore hurried to the rear platform of the wild coach and saw the approaching headlight of the second train. He seized a signal lantern and started waving it frantically from the coach's platform. But the fast-moving train closed in rapidly on the slow-moving coach, which had lost its motive power and was coasting to a stop. The engineer on the approaching train, paying no heed to the frantic signals of Joe Baldwin, apparently had not yet seen what was ahead. But Joe stuck to his point and to his signaling, swinging the lantern more and more furiously. The train plunged on. Finally, with a great crash, it rocketed into the wild coach, completely demolishing it. In the terrific impact, conductor Joe Baldwin was decapitated. A witness at the wreck recalled that in the meeting of the engine with the free car, Joe Baldwin's lantern was waved until the last second and then was somehow hurled meteor-like away from the tracks. It fell in an adjacent swamp some distance from the wreckage, rolled to an upright position, sputtered, caught up again, and continued to sit there and burn brightly until it was picked up and moved. Shortly after this fatal accident, a mysterious light began to appear along the coastline tracks in the Mako section. It has been appearing there over the years ever since. In fact, it has become quite a fad for parties to make night excursions to Mako Station to see this weird light come swinging down the tracks, only to disappear when anyone gets close to it. The ghostly performance has afforded midnight thrills to many hundreds. Summertime is the popular season for paying the Mako Station a light visit. Dark and moonless nights are better because they afford a clearer, sharper view of the light. Cars can be parked just off the highway near a country store, and then the ghost party can walk 100 yards or so down a lonely road toward the railroad tracks. The cheerful and hilarious voices of such a party are likely to drop off into whispers at this stage of the expedition. It is usually a somewhat silent group that climbs stealthily up the cindered path to await the appearance of the phenomenal light. And then the light appears. It will show itself at intervals of 15 minutes or so, and as the watchers stand there in the night trying to dope the thing out, they are sure to recall the story of how conductor Joe Baldwin, waving his lantern desperately at an approaching train, lost his head and his life on that very spot. From a vantage point, the light is first seen at some distance down the track, maybe a mile away. It starts with a flicker over the left rail, very much as if someone had struck a match. Then it grows a little brighter and begins creeping up the track toward you. As it becomes brighter, it increases in momentum. Then it dashes forward with a rather incredible velocity, at the same time swinging faster and faster from side to side. Finally, it comes to a sudden halt, some 75 yards away, glows there like a fiery eye, and then speeds backward down the track, as if retreating from some unseen danger. It stops where it made its first appearance, hangs there ominously for a moment, like a moon in miniature, and then vanishes into nothingness. That is the usual pattern of the appearance, although different people always report seeing the thing in a slightly different fashion. The light appears over and over again. Weather and the seasons seem to have no influence on its visibility. It has been known to vanish for a month at a time, only to reappear several nights in rapid succession. It seems to be a matter of Joe's discretion. Stories that deal with Joe Baldwin's nocturnal trips in search of his head include one that dates back to 1873. In that particular year, railroad men say, a second bright light appeared, and the two lights, shining with the brightness of 25-watt electric bulbs, as estimated later, would meet one another from opposite directions. It took an earthquake to stop Joe Baldwin's nightly jaunt, and then only temporarily. For a short time after the quake of 1886, the two lights disappeared. Soon, however, a single light reappeared, weaving silently along the tracks near Mako Station. Folks knew then that Joe Baldwin was again looking for his head. In 1889, the train bearing Grover Cleveland, President of the United States, paused near Mako Station after dark to take on wood and water. This predated the Atlantic coastline, and the road was then the Wilmington, Manchester, and Augusta line. The night was balmy, and President Cleveland alighted from his special coach to take a stroll along the tracks. While walking along, he saw a train signalman and two lanterns, one red and the other green.
"Tell me," said the president, "what is the purpose of carrying two signal lanterns?"
Before the presidential train started rolling toward Wilmington again, President Cleveland had the full story of Joe Baldwin's ghost light. He also found out that two lanterns were used at Mako Station so that engineers would not be deceived by the ghostly weaving of the Joe Baldwin light. B.M. Jones of the auditing department of the Atlantic coastline at Wilmington was on the scene when the presidential train stopped. He was a small, barefoot boy at the time, but he remembered well being hoisted up so that the affable President Cleveland could shake his hand. He was also well acquainted with the Joe Baldwin light. Mr. Jones recalled that one night, years ago, he was with a group of boys walking down the tracks near the station at Mako. The light, he said, appeared down the track ahead of them, weaved along toward them, and then suddenly described an arc and landed over beside the track in the swamp, just as if it had been thrown there from someone's hand. That was what had happened to Joe Baldwin's lantern on the night of the wreck. An Atlantic coastline operations official, veteran of 40 years of railroading, has seen the light from the cab of a locomotive. He knows of instances when trains stopped on account of it. On at least one occasion, he was riding with an engineer who saw a light ahead at this point, set his brakes, and was beginning to stop when the light disappeared. Three other Atlantic coastline employees reported seeing the light in recent times. J.R. Blinn, after viewing it from the south, circled and looked at it from the north. He said it definitely was not a light from a moving automobile, because the Mako light moves with a jerky up-and-down motion and stays in one place for long intervals. As it rises and falls, it is sometimes visible for 5 minutes at one spot. He said he knew the explanation lies somewhere in the realm of natural phenomena, but that he could not explain it. Miss Frankie Murphy was another witness. "Sometimes," she said, "the ghost light is so bright that you can almost read by it. It rises up from the side of the tracks, comes forward to you, and disappears. You can see the reflection along the rails." Many explanations of this strange phenomenon have been suggested over the years. The most plausible is that the light comes from automobile headlights as cars pass somewhere in the vicinity and are either seen along a line of vision just across the top of the tracks or are reflected in some way by the steel rails or something else. But several things tend to disprove this explanation and to explode the theory behind it. The light was appearing before automobiles were in use, before the paved highways in the region existed. Also, roads have been rerouted several times with no apparent effect on the light. And some years ago, an interested group arranged to close temporarily all roads and highways in the vicinity to see if that would stop the light. Persons were posted at all intersections and points along the roads and highways for some distance from Mako. And for more than 1 hour, one midnight, no automobile traffic was allowed to enter the area.
but the unearthly light danced and swung and bobbed up and down the track just the same. On one occasion, a machine gun detachment from Fort Bragg encamped briefly at Mako to solve the mystery, or at least perforate it. They did neither. Men with scientific training have tackled the problem. People in the Mako community will tell you this, but no one has ever come forward with an explanation that stands. A Washington, D.C. investigator visited Mako to explain the thing scientifically, but Joe was too fast for him. The scientist said, however, that he had seen enough to convince him that the light was no ignis fatuus, as he had sought to establish. Others have said that the light comes from some phosphorescent formation. But at the same time, they tell you that what they know about this type of illumination does not indicate that it races up and down in a limited area. The Mako light never varies a fraction from a given course there at the scene of the one-time railroad wreck. It always appears about 3 feet above the left rail facing east. Always. The people of New Hanover and Brunswick counties are not among those who seek explanations. They dismiss unbelievers and the entire matter by saying, "It's Joe Baldwin's light." That Joe is still swinging his eerie lantern and looking for his head. And some observers claim that they have been close enough to the light to see the guards that are part of the lantern construction. In recent years, heedless youngsters have adopted the dangerous habit of parking on top of and across the railroad tracks at Mako for a better view of the lights up and down the track. Unless the practice is stopped, Atlantic coastline officials say, Joe Baldwin is going to have some company.
Thank you for listening to Tales from Tar Heel Ghost. Now please, have a relaxing evening. If you can. This program has been recorded for a print and visually impaired audience for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For more information, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Or go to www.triangleredingservice.org.